Morning and welcome to the Health Affairs briefing on the release of our Medicare Advantage papers, which are being released this morning as web exclusives. This is a very important and timely topic, as you know, and it's a topic that in various ways Washington and the country broadly have been debating for quite some time. Going back to the roots of the HMO movement and some of the earlier days of Medicare, there was, of course, always a question about whether having Medicare less oriented toward fee-for-service and more oriented toward the kinds of payment mechanisms and the arrangement of provision of services that were inherent in HMOs, all of that was considered a reasonable component to begin to integrate into Medicare. So again, going back into the 1970s at minimum, there was a concern about potentially having Medicare HMOs come into Medicare to provide those advantages to the Medicare population. Many of you in the audience will have covered some of the debates that go back to the 70s and 80s over arcane things like AAPCC rates and so forth and so on. And, of course, the general premise, as you know, was that organizing care and paying for care in this way would potentially advantage Medicare beneficiaries and advantage the U.S. taxpayers, because Medicare HMOs were supposed to be providing these services at 95% of the cost of traditional Medicare. Over the years, there were ups and downs in this program. Some of you will have lived through the great mass exodus from plans in the late 1990s and early part of the 2000s as a consequence of some sentiment that the rates were too low and there was too much geographical variation due to these arcane AAPCC rates. Many of you will have lived through the attempts to shore up the program, and of course, all of you lived through the Medicare Modernization Act debate and the advent of Medicare Advantage plans. And as we will hear about in more detail this morning, at that point, more plans that were not necessarily structured along the lines of capitated rates or HMOs and so forth came into the program and created a number of the controversies that we are living through today. Most specifically, as you know, the recent set of debates has been around whether the taxpayers are gaining value or the beneficiaries are gaining value through these plans. And as you will know, there is now a considerable body of opinion that suggests that many of the plans under Medicare Advantage are in fact being quote-unquote overpaid relative to traditional Medicare. There's considerable debate about whether the services provided beneficiaries are worth that additional cost. And most recently, there have been debates about taking those quote-unquote overpayments away from the plans in order to use the funds to finance other things. In 2007, of course, the debate was over using those for the SCHIP expansion, and just in the past year, we saw a debate about using the funds in part to finance the offsets to physician payment. So lots of food for thought and lots of debate, and that is why we brought out these several articles on Medicare Advantage today. We're going to hear presentations from a couple of the authors, followed by commentary from some of the people who've been weighing these things in the Senate, most specifically on the Finance Committee, and then finally a representative of the private industry that is in the business of providing some of these plans, specifically Ovations, a division of United Healthcare. Let me introduce first our first speaker, who is Marcia Gold from Mathematica Policy Research. Her paper, which you have in your packet and may have read, is Medicare's Private Plans, a report card on Medicare Advantage. And let me tell you just a little bit more about Marcia before she begins. Marcia is a senior fellow at Mathematica in Washington, D.C., and a nationally known expert on healthcare delivery and financing, especially in managed care and public programs, including Medicare and Medicaid. Her expertise covers the organization and financing of medical care and its implications for access to care. Her current studies include the Medicare Advantage Monitoring Program, which has been tracking the use of private plans in Medicare, and several studies that aim to synthesize or evaluate efforts to improve healthcare quality and reduce racial and ethnic disparities. Her work has been funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the Kaiser Family Foundation, whose premises we're delighted to be availing ourselves this morning, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, and the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation of the Department of Health and Human Services. So with that, Marcia.
Thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here. The papers that you're going to look at cover an awful lot of ground, and I hope you'll have a chance to go through them. What I realized in preparing for this is that it would be very easy to get very complex, so I'm just going to skim the surface and tell you some of the key points that I think come out, and hope that you'll look at the paper. As Susan mentioned, there's always been a role for private plans in Medicare since the beginning, and the latest incarnation is the Medicare Advantage Program, which was set up as a result of the Medicare Modernization Act. It put a lot more money into private plans and attempted to get broader regional distribution through regional PPOs. That's one of the forms of coordinated care, or I may use the word managed care, that's around. They're sort of looser and complement the HMOs that were always part of the program. But a lot of these options have been around since earlier, but they didn't take off, and I think the extra money was designed to help them do it. I've been following these programs for a long time, and I'm building on that and a series of articles I've written on the paper for, written before on this topic for this paper. I'm relying mainly on public MA data, which isn't always as detailed as one might like, and discussions with MA firms in this. I'm not sure people realize, but the private plans, the ones that coordinate AB and prescription drug benefits, have really become a major part of the Medicare program. Among people who get prescription drug benefits, 1 in 3 is in an MA plan, and almost a quarter of all beneficiaries are in there, and that's been relatively rapid growth since the MMA. And in a companion paper by my colleagues at MedPAC, they show that that enrollment has come at a cost because the payments have exceeded those in traditional Medicare. So the question is, what do we know about what we're getting for this payment? So characteristics of MA expansion. One of the goals of this program was to have there be more private plan choices across the country, and in fact, including rural areas. And in fact, that's happened. There are a number of different statistics and ways of looking at it, but the choice has expanded substantially. But it hasn't expanded in the way Congress hoped. It's not really in coordinated care, although there's been some growth in the number of those plans offered. But it's been more in a program that was put into the Balanced Budget Act in the late 1990s, actually, I think, from what I hear from people, as a response to Right to Life, and not really, it was almost anti-managed care, the private fee-for-service option. The regional PPOs, which Congress intended to be the source of growth, are there, but they haven't really expanded, and they're not really viable in the market for reasons I go into in the paper. And so what you've had is that available coordinated care plans, HMOs and PPOs, are still fairly uneven nationally. Less than 4% of rural beneficiaries are enrolled in those plans. And half of the growth of the MA program since 2003, when the payments were raised, is in private fee-for-service. A large share of that in group accounts from employers. And special needs plans, which I think we probably won't focus too much on in this briefing, are another quarter. The changes reflect responses to market incentives. When I talk with plans, a lot of this makes sense. There are some very hard things about setting up networks in rural areas that are relatively intractable and don't make them great business opportunities as well. And a lot of those, no matter how much money you put at it, seem unlikely to change. You're also, MA got very attractive to plans because of the increased price and the more beneficiaries that were available, but people do what's easiest, and so they did the private fee-for-service because it was a lot easier and you could do it nationally and you didn't have to deal with networks. And the groups liked it because the employers were facing all these requirements to account for their health care expenses, and the overpayments gave them some good options. So what's the implications for performance? We did get more choice, but as my colleague's paper said, Medicare pays 150 13% more for each MA enrollee that's enrolled in the program now. And they pay even more for those in private fee-for-service because of where private fee-for-service is located. Administratively, this is just a terribly complex program for everyone as you talk to people. You have a large number of plans that CMS has to process, approve, beneficiaries have to make sense of and compare, many more than we do as employed populations that typically have retiree choices. And a lot of those plans don't seem to differ from each other in a lot of ways, or if they do, you can't tell how they do by what's out there. And a lot of the complexity, too, I should say, especially for the industry, is a response to the legislative sausage that made Part D and the drug benefit acceptable. You have a lot of requirements for the drug benefit for low-income subsidy plans that convert to a very complex MA program. And so that's not really very efficient. The biggest problem for the Medicare program has always been that the benefits, while very important and valuable, still leave beneficiaries with a lot of out-of-pocket costs. There's no limit on those in Medicare, and that's why a lot of people have bought Medigap policy, something at least till recently none of us really had to deal with. And what's happened is this program hasn't really fixed that at all. What it's done, though, is with the extra money, it's allowed some of the plans to set up a low-cost Medigap option for people who can't afford it. And that's been valuable to those people who have it. But it's meant that the other people who voluntarily are supposed to have a choice of going either way can't get those benefits. And also, some of the cost sharing doesn't really help some of the people who are sickest. And I go into some of those figures in my paper, particularly for private fee-for-service plans that, on average, they compete pretty well with HMOs, but if you're sick, you're likely to have higher out-of-pocket cost. We care a lot about quality these days, and right now there's no evidence of positive effects on quality. I mean, I think the most fundamental reason is that private fee-for-service plans weren't set up to do that. So even if plans try and do it, they're sort of banging their heads against the wall in a lot of ways, and they have a lot of legal restrictions. I think there is some potential. A lot of people think there's some potential in the special needs plans, but the special needs plans have more theory than potential, and there's been a lot of them, and Congress recently attempted to enact some requirements in MIPA that would favor the more managed special needs plans. But a lot of the people in there now were just basically rolled over from a different option, so whatever potential that has isn't really showing up yet. One of the options people said in the beginning is that private fee-for-service could be a transition to more coordinated care. And that's certainly appealing if it were true, but in the analysis of the data that I go through, there's no real evidence that they do that. There's a lot more PPOs and HMOs around, but the enrollment in them isn't increasing very fast, and firms say they're basically trying to give people what they want, so they're not pushing one form of plan over the other. And the HMOs, especially some of the more traditional ones, are having a hard time distinguishing themselves in the marketplace. So what are the policy implications? I think one of the clear messages, hopefully, from the numbers in these papers is that the MA program is changing fast. And so policymakers, if they want to have an effect on what's offered, because it's a lot easier to fix something before it's changed than change it once it's happened. They need to decide fast when private plans are valuable and at what cost. And like my authors, I think the other papers, I think I agree there'll probably always be a role for private plans. The question is what and at what price. So that's important to decide. But assuming there's going to be some role for private plans, I think what's been most distressing for me, and I'm someone who's going to be on Medicare one of these days, it's something that has been really important to me, to my family, to my friends, and it's a really important program. And right now, I don't see that this program is being run in a way that really has the stewardship and the governance and the transparency from a policy perspective that you would hope for such an important program. It's been very hard to get information about the program so that anyone, regardless of their orientation, can analyze it. We need more transparency. And I think, hopefully, there'll be more role for Congress as an oversight body. If we know why we want private plans, we can develop some performance measures that get reported annually on a fairly granular level that would help people see what we're getting. For example, people have been upset about beneficiary confusion and whether that exists or whether there's problems of access. It's possible you could have indicators of rapid disenrollment or complaints and get those to people. You could compare it to last year, see if it's getting better, see which states the problems are in, and really see what's going on. And you could look at a number of things, and I think, in fairness, look at it for the regular Medicare program as well, so you have a level playing field, and I agree with Brian and Bob that that concept is an important one. So right now we know Medicare is an important program, but we know we're spending a lot more, but frankly, we don't know what we're buying, and that's a big problem.
Thank you very much, Marcia. Now we'll move to another presentation from yet another of our authors, Brian Dowd, who is a co-author with Robert Berenson on their paper, Medicare Advantage Plans at a Crossroads Yet Again. We're always coming up against these crossroads again and again in U.S. health policy, and we're yet at another one in Medicare Advantage. Let me just briefly say that Brian is a professor in the Division of Health Policy and Management at the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota, where he co-chairs the program in Human Rights and Health and is the principal investigator for the CMS Master Research and Demonstration Contract. He currently serves as chair of the Methods Council of Academy Health, and his recent research includes Part D enrollment, Medicare reform, insurance theory, and causal modeling, among other things. So join me in welcoming Brian Dowd.
Thank you very much, Susan. Thanks to Health Affairs and Kaiser for hosting us here. Thanks for bringing me out. I would say I know Bob Berenson would like to be here, but I think he might be in Spain or France or somewhere, so he probably doesn't wish all that much that he could be here. It's amazing to me how much progress two authors with somewhat disparate points of view can make when each co-author is keeping the other on a short leash. But this is my second major project with Bob, and I always enjoy working with him and always learn a lot working with him. I think that it would be easy to get the impression today that the purpose of the event really is to call into question the role of private health plans in Medicare. I just want to say I can't speak for all the participants, but certainly that emphatically is not the purpose of our paper. We realize that private plans have been available to Medicare beneficiaries since the inception of the program in some form. Of course, the most important change was capitated payments based on local fee-for-service costs in the early 1980s. And the most important feature of that payment system was how the rates were set, and setting them on local fee-for-service cost was the way that they were set, despite some good advice to the contrary at the time. With private plans in Medicare, as you look over the history, there really has never been any intent that whatever benefits might be produced by private plans should come at increased program cost. We find nothing in the history of the program or the legislation to suggest that that's the case. Now, the problem with the way that they pay private plans in Medicare is that we get these wide disparities, geographic disparities. The per capita cost in Miami, I think, still are about roughly twice the per capita cost in Minneapolis. So what happens is that the private plans are able to take the largesse in Miami and to produce a lot of government finance, that's the key part, government financed benefits for beneficiaries in Miami that are not available to beneficiaries in lower payment areas. Payment disparities, we attempted to address them with lots of legislation. You can see a summary there. And some of those led to plan withdrawals and benefit cuts. In the 2003 MMA legislation, we increased incentives for private plans. As a result, private plans in some areas were overpaid for the entitlement benefit package. I want to emphasize three words, the entitlement benefit package. And so if you think that there is an entitlement benefit package and you think that the role of the government might be to buy the entitlement benefit package at the lowest possible cost in the most efficient way, then we would not be having a one-sided discussion about overpayment of private plans. We would also be having a discussion about overpayment of fee-for-service as a deliverer of that entitlement benefit package in areas where private plans can provide the entitlement benefit package for a lower rate than fee-for-service. Now, we think that there are advantages to both public and private plans. On the public plan side, traditional fee-for-service Medicare, you certainly have universal geographic coverage, and you have substantial market pricing power. Now, that has a good side and a bad side. If we have problems with concentrated markets for healthcare services, then a concentrated purchaser who really pays no attention at all to the supply and demand conditions in each market area, which is the way fee-for-service Medicare works, is a good thing because you're just going to run over the local market pricing power. That's bilateral monopoly, and it's better than one-sided monopoly. It's better than unaddressed monopoly. But the other side of it is concentrated market power in a competitive health services market is monopsony, and monopsony is inefficient. So we're on a delicate balance there, and we need to think carefully about that. Another good thing about fee-for-service Medicare over the years is there have been some very important payment innovations in fee-for-service Medicare. There's also the attraction of low administrative costs, but the question that we ask is, are they too low? I had an interesting conversation with Bob. I said at one point in writing the paper, Bob, it seems to me that any rational health plan, public or private, would spend a dollar if they could save more than a dollar through that investment in administrative activities of any kind. He said, Brian, I had 100 ways that I could have spent a dollar to save more than a dollar in fee-for-service Medicare, but there is not a budget for that. You cannot take the money that has been contributed to the Medicare program to finance Part A and Part B benefits and spend it on anything you want. So if you want to give the administrator of CMS, as Bob was at one point, the option of making those cost-saving investments, we have to figure out a way to do that budgetarily. And finally, the potential advantage of fee-for-service Medicare is to take the lead in controversial reforms. Private plans also have some advantages. The main one is their flexibility. They can set physician and hospital payment rates without congressional oversight. They can contract with providers pretty much any way they want on the basis of price and quality. They can use competitive pricing when appropriate. They can make those cost-saving and cost-effective investments. Now, by cost-effective, I mean an administrative activity that costs more, but people are willing to pay for it. So the example that we use is a plan might add more telephone operators to their helpline to reduce response times, and they should do that if the beneficiaries are willing to pay the higher premiums that go with it. And finally, they can coordinate care across the inpatient, outpatient, and pharmaceutical settings. And what we know more about the quality of care in Medicare than we do about any other sector of the U.S. health economy, and what we know is that quality of care is roughly equivalent in the two sectors. So we think that both public and private plans have advantages and disadvantages. We don't think either type of plan needs to be propped up with special subsidies. And we think that consumers, not Congress, CMS, or MedPAC, can judge best which health plan features are what are worth what they cost. So some policy options. Well, MedPAC, it seems to us, is kind of back to the future. We're going to start paying, under this proposal, the private plans at 100% of local fee-for-service costs rather than 95% as we did in the past. I think the result is going to be wide disparities in government-financed benefits and questionable government savings. An alternative, of course, would be to actually buy the entitlement benefit package at the most from the most efficient plan at the lowest cost in each county in the U.S. That would be competitive bidding, the near universal choice in commercial insurance markets, the way I've gotten my health insurance for the past 28 years at the University of Minnesota. But if we're going to do bidding, what we need is a level playing field. So what exactly does that mean? Well, I'm open to suggestions. We had a few ideas. Here are some of the ones that we suggested. We think fee-for-service Medicare should be allowed to make cost-saving investments in administrative efficiency. But we also think in a level playing field, fee-for-service's administrative costs would include all their administrative costs. That might include the Social Security Administration collecting part of the premium, the Postal Service. Those costs are administrative costs. UnitedHealthcare incurs them for its plans. And so if those are costs incurred by fee-for-service, we ought to put them on the tab for fee-for-service Medicare. We think that, as Marcia mentioned, fee-for-service Medicare and private fee-for-service plans ought to meet the same quality reporting, and here's an interesting one, network adequacy requirements as private plans. Fee-for-service Medicare does not guarantee you access to providers. It guarantees you only access to health insurance. And we think that it's reasonable to consider a plan under which fee-for-service Medicare, like MA plans, could offer a one-stop shopping product that has the inpatient, outpatient, pharmaceutical benefit all rolled up in one. So here, I guess, are the takeaway points. We think that overpaying health plans for the entitlement benefit package is wasteful. We don't care whether it's fee-for-service Medicare or a private plan. Overpaying is a bad idea. We're concerned that Congress and the courts have prevented CMS from using competitive bidding to purchase any health plan or health care service in the Medicare program. There are 10 examples of that. Even after mandating demonstrations, having the demonstrations evaluated and finding that they were successful, DME comes to mind. So we think that both fee-for-service Medicare and private plans are here to stay, and rightly so. It would not just be bad politics, it would be bad economic policy to get rid of either fee-for-service Medicare or private plans. We think Congress ought to stop wasting time and money trying to pull the program to one end of the continuum or the other and start addressing the real fiscal problems of the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Now we're going to hear in sequence from two people who've been ruminating over all of these issues from their perches on the Senate Finance Committee. First, we'll be hearing from Liz Fowler on the Democratic side and subsequently from Kristen Bass on the Republican side. First of all, let me tell you a little bit more about Liz, though. Liz rejoined the Senate Finance Committee earlier this year to serve as senior counsel to the chair and chief health counsel. Previously, she served as the chief health and entitlements counsel of the committee with responsibility for overseeing health policy issues within the committee's jurisdiction, including Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP, health tax issues, and initiatives to provide health coverage to the uninsured. During her hiatus from the Finance Committee, Liz was the Vice President of Public Policy for WellPoint. She has nearly 20 years of experience in health services research and health policy, previously having been an attorney with Hogan & Hartson and having spent nearly 5 years as a health services researcher with Health System Minnesota. So, Liz?
Thanks very much. I appreciate the invitation to come speak on a very timely topic. I would ask for the reporters in the room that my remarks be kept off the record. I realize you're probably recording this, but one rule of being on the Hill, you never want to see your name in print ever. So if that's okay. So I was very pleased to see that Health Affairs had undertaken the issue of Medicare Advantage. It's extremely timely, as I mentioned, as Medicare Advantage is at a crossroad, and so I think with the change in administration, I think we're going to see a lot of changes in the program. So it's very appropriate at this time to reexamine where the program has been and where it's going. I appreciated in particular the reminder of the history of the private plans in Medicare and the full examination of the current state of enrollment and payment that the authors have provided in this issue. From my own history, I was working with Carlos Zaragoza at CMS, which was then HCFA, back under the first Bush administration in the Office of Legislation and Policy. And one of the issues that I did handle at that time was considering whether to move Medicare payments from 95 to 100% of fee-for-service. And look how far we've come since that time. I did work for Senator Moynihan during the BBRA and BIPA time when the floors were created and then the mezzanine floors, the payment floors, and also worked on MMA and then most recently on MIPA. And I think there's a lot of questions about the purpose of public private plans in Medicare. And the problem is, and I think this is that there are a lot of competing priorities, and depending on which member you ask, there's different reasons to have the private plans there and thinking about the payment. Congress has been sort of schizophrenic in its treatment of these plans, and I think that it really is because there are a lot of different reasons to have plans and a lot of different competing, I think, policy objectives. And basically, I think the major purpose of the program, as all members on both sides of the aisle would agree, is to provide choice and efficiency and an integrated benefit. To have A, B, and D benefits and under one umbrella, I think is a very attractive and appropriate purpose. The floors were put into place because rural members were looking at their urban counterparts and with a little bit of envy and wondering why all these extra benefits are provided to urban beneficiaries but not to rural beneficiaries. And so at the time working for a rural member, I know that, well, I guess at the time the floors were created, but I know that there was a lot of consternation that the playing field at that point was unlevel. But even after the BBRA and BIPA floors, you found that plans did not come into rural areas. And at the time, working for Senator Baucus, looking back at the payments, we said, look, you know, the floors in Montana were 140% of fee-for-service, and then we still didn't have any plans in there. And that was because of the difficulty with the network and getting a network, because a lot of the providers, there are only two cities in Montana with more than one hospital. If you can believe it, that's how small the state is. And for the most part, the providers were a little bit reluctant, I think, to negotiate rates with these private plans. And so we never did have private plans until the private fee-for-service program waived a lot of those requirements. There's been a broad recognition that we've now gone too far. I think even those who were involved in MMA would say they didn't envision the program being populated mostly with private plans that don't manage care and don't have a network. And I think now we're sort of looking back and trying to figure out where do we go next in light of the new evidence and in light of some of the interesting evidence that's provided in some of these papers. And I think speaking for Senator Baucus, one of the principles that he had was, and I think going forward will be his view, is that we want to make sure that the program makes sense for beneficiaries, for plans, and for taxpayers. And at this point, it might work for many beneficiaries. Certainly, they enjoy extra benefits. But I would also argue that care coordination and managing care is a more important extra benefit than eyeglasses and dental. And what you see in the rural areas is that they haven't, these plans have not been managing care. They do not provide care coordination services. And I think that's a real problem. So the out-of-pocket protection is also valuable, I think, but even then, not all plans are providing that benefit as well, as Marcia has shown. And I think this has become true, particularly after a drug benefit was instituted in Medicare, that was the extra benefit that a lot of rural members sort of coveted from their urban counterparts, and now that playing field really has been leveled, the extra benefit that I'd say that is of most value is actually making sure that patients with chronic conditions are receiving care coordination. So as we found and as the previous speakers have pointed out, choice has come at a very high price, which means that right now the program does not make sense for taxpayers. The fact that Medicare's trust fund will go broke 18 months earlier due to our overpayments is really, I think, a fact that is really eye-opening. And the fact that beneficiaries across the board are paying $3 extra per month to subsidize these plans also does not make any sense from a taxpayer perspective. And, you know, I think there's also a recognition that a lot of plans have been in the program for the right reasons, and they've stayed through the stayed in the program through thick and thin. And so they stayed in during the lean years after BBA and have continued to provide a valuable service to beneficiaries. And I think those are the sort of plans that we want to make sure stay in the program. And as the we don't want to throw out the proverbial baby with the bathwater as we go forward. But many, many plans, it seems to me, looking at the landscape, are in the program to make a quick buck. They recognize that the financial proposition provided under the current program is just too good to be true. They want to get in, make a quick buck until Congress figures it out and takes the buck away. And I think that has led to a lot of what we've seen as the marketing abuses and some of the enrollment abuses that the MIPA bill in July tried to mitigate. On the flip side, I also want to acknowledge that in the past, Medicare has not been the best business partner for plans, for private plans. For those plans that are in the program for the right reason, it's very hard to anticipate what Congress might do. And I think we've tried to be sensitive to the fact that wide fluctuations in payment and policy and the way that Congress treats plans makes it very difficult to stay in the program for some of these plans. And I want to acknowledge that as well. So the question is where we go from here. I think there's no question, and any of my colleagues, if they were sitting up here from the Democratic side on the House or the Senate, would acknowledge that further cuts are coming to the program, that payments are so high that they really don't make any sense right now. There really is no rationale for the level of payments. I like the notion of increasing accountability, and that's come out in a couple of the papers, talking about better transparency and the need to really better understand the bids and the bidding, what the plans are bidding, the benefits that they're providing, and to get a better sense of who's disenrolling and who's enrolling in the programs, and also some of the consumer side of things. We want to know what's happening to patients who are enrolled in the plans. As Marcia pointed out, there hasn't been very strong stewardship of the program. I anticipate that's going to change with the new administration. I think they're going to have a very keen eye towards a better stewardship of the program. And along with that, and in combination with Congress, I expect that we're going to increase standards and expectations. What exactly do we expect from these plans going forward in terms of care management? I know I've, at least talking in, amongst colleagues, trying to figure out, you know, does it make sense to provide extra payments, but only, for example, where you get something in return. As Uwe Reinhart testified before the Finance Committee last week, I only give a tip when I get something in return, and right now we're just sort of giving a tip to these plans without the expectation that you get something back for it. For others, I think the notion that you're paying extra for care management when that's what these plans are supposed to be doing in the first place is, they swallow hard at that thought. On the other hand, I think those same members of Congress feel the same way about pay-for-performance and value-based purchasing for hospitals and doctors, that shouldn't they be providing that level of care without having to pay them extra. But since we're doing it on one side of the program, on the fee-for-service side, or we're looking at going in that direction, it's appropriate to think about doing that on the plan side as well. I think the big question is what we do in terms of payment, and we're really rethinking that quite extensively. We're spending a lot of time at the staff level thinking about what the payments should look like, again, taking all of these principles into account. I'm not sure that 100% of fee-for-service makes sense. That's me personally speaking, and I'm just saying that because looking across the board, as Brian Dowd pointed out, you're building into the system, if you take 100% of fee-for-service, building in all the inefficiencies and the geographic variation in Medicare and all the payment flaws of all the other payment systems into the plan payment side. And I'm not sure that that's really the right measure. Competitive bidding does make sense. I know it's been hard. Congress doesn't do a very good job of competitive bidding, or at least when it does finally decide to act, can change its mind at the last minute before something is implemented at the behest of those industries and companies that are affected. We're also considering potentially some sort of blended payment. And frankly, we're looking for a lot of direction from MedPAC. And we're looking, we asked MedPAC and MIPA to come up with some recommendations for alternative payment mechanisms. We've since asked MedPAC to expedite their work on this. And so I'm sorry I don't have an answer for you for what we'll do going forward, but our door is open and look forward to working on this in the coming months. But I do expect that the way that we pay plans and the expectations that we have on of them will change in the coming year.
Thank you very much, Liz. So we can conclude that Medicare Advantage will be at a crossroads yet again after the current crossroads. Okay. Now we're going to hear from Kristen Bass, who's a health policy advisor for the Senate Finance Committee and specifically an advisor to Senator Charles Grassley, who, as you know, is the ranking member of the Finance Committee. Her responsibilities on the committee include Parts C and D of Medicare and private insurance. Prior to joining the Finance Committee, she was the Senior Vice President for Policy at the Healthcare Leadership Council, and before that, a Vice President at WellPoint, where she headed the insurer's Federal Affairs Office. Before that, she was a lobbyist for the American Association of Health Plans. She's also worked as a healthcare marketing consultant in New York City. Kristen.
Thank you. Liz and I were just laughing at the fact that the one plan that seems to be represented among the speakers is WellPoint, so happy for them. My comments, too, are off the record. Again, we try never to be quoted, so please don't quote me, anyone in the audience. One of the things that I have found lacking in this entire discussion is any open discussion of the fact that the underlying Medicare fee-for-service program hugely distorts the market for healthcare services. We know, for instance, from Lewin data from 2005 that private payers on average are paying 120%-ish for hospital costs of what Medicare pays. We know that Medicare pays, this is MedPAC data, somewhere around 83% of what private payers payers pay with respect to physician costs. And so some of what goes on with respect to health plans is that their cost structure, simply because Medicare is price-fixed, price-controlled program, their cost structure is significantly different because they typically have had to contract with providers themselves. Now, the big exception to this is the private fee-for-service program. I'm going to ask everybody in the audience a little question. How many people in the audience have a plan that is a non-network plan? Your own health insurance, raise your hand. Okay. How many people, given the opportunity, would love to have a plan that was a non-network plan? Raise your hand. And the hands that aren't going up are only from people who are too young to realize that it's really, really fun to be able to go to any doctor you want anytime.
Or else they're just really responsible human beings.
Right. You guys win major brownie points. Okay, so, and does anybody know the reason that we have the private fee-for-service plans to begin with? There's a group called the National Right to Life Organization, and they are very concerned that there will be rationing in Medicare, especially on the private plan side. And their view has been that, and they're very concerned about the end-of-life issues, and their view has been that people ought to be able to buy using their own cash. They should be able to go out and buy a health plan that in no way limits their choice of physicians or hospitals, because their view is that HMOs have, because of capitation, have an incentive to limit care. And so in response to that, Republicans insisted on these products being available. Now, at the same time, the way that MMA was set up was that it retained the county-based bidding. And what that means is that the plans are able to pick on a county-based basis the counties that are most profitable for them. And as all of the panelists have pointed out, there are very few in the way of capital costs incurred when you just basically go and set up a claims processing unit. And so this really has been a wonderful business opportunity for the plans. And lo and behold, most beneficiaries would prefer to be in a product that has extra benefits, but very little in the way of limits on the doctors and hospitals they can go to. So it's really no surprise that these plans have taken off. Senator Grassley, who I work for, believes very strongly in beneficiaries being able to have a choice of plans. He believes very strongly that it is hideously unfair that, lo, these many years, beneficiaries in Miami have had all these extra benefits, and Iowans, where costs are half, roughly, what they are in Miami, have had virtually no choices of benefits. And so from the Republican perspective and a lot of the rural members, as Liz has pointed out, it was very important that there be these extra choices. And so in a large part of rural areas, if you look at Kansas, there are virtually no network plans at all. At least in Iowa, we have some. MIPA did a very nice thing in that it figured out a way to allow for network plans to where there are network plans for private fee-for-service plans to have to transition over to become network plans while retaining, in areas where plans have been unable to form networks, retaining the option for beneficiaries to choose. And that, I think, was a really nice policy step forward. In addition, MIPA has made those plans far more accountable with respect to quality reporting and some of the things that the other plans have to do. I beg to differ a little bit with Brian and Marcia in that there actually are some measures that show that MA plans have greater quality than regular fee-for-service. We all know that the regular fee-for-service product is completely siloed. There is nobody in fee-for-service that really has an incentive in trying to make sure that a given beneficiary's care is coordinated. My grandmother's doctors had no idea all the different drugs she was on and that some of them were giving her hallucinations. They just didn't know, and they had no reason to care. And in a coordinated care kind of a product, there is some better coordination. There are better stats on beta blockers after heart attack and a variety of other things. It isn't as much better as we would hope. And truly, the coordination in private fee-for-service plans, while some plans have tried to do it, has been sorely lacking. And we certainly should be expecting more coordination out of the other forms of Medicare Advantage plans. So I would agree with folks who are calling for that, and certainly Senator Grassley would as well. So I, you know, from the Republican perspective, where we're left is we really believed, Republicans believed very strongly that, one, the Medicare fee-for-service program, despite the cost controls, is hugely growing out of control. We know that it's a hockey stick in terms of cost increases, and that the federal government, Congress has not been all that good at trying to constrain the cost. The fact that we now have to fix the SGR, the physician growth rate, we have to fix that every year because while 10 years ago Congress in effect set a global budget for doctors, nobody has the heart to actually enforce the thing. So every year Congress now has to come up with tens of billions of dollars, and it'll grow over time, to fix that. Right now, I don't know if any of you have ever had a family member who's on oxygen, but there are two kinds of oxygen. There is the kind that comes in the containers that actually contain oxygen, and there is the kind that you have what's called a condenser, and it basically takes the ambient air and condenses the oxygen in it and delivers it to the person who's using the machine. Right now, despite the fact that Congress knows very well that we are paying for deliveries of oxygen to people who are on condensers, Congress was, frankly, unable politically to change that last year, and it was not because Liz Fowler's staff did not try diligently, and my colleagues on Senator Grassley's staff did not try diligently. It's just very, very difficult to micromanage Medicare in a really effective way. And so from the Republican viewpoint, and this will be news to none of you, our expectation is that if we could have moved Medicare, if Medicare could be moved toward a more private sector basis, you would have a far better ability to have market forces help with figuring out what's the best rationalization for payment, how to better get rid of fraud. We have $1 billion durable medical equipment problem in Miami, and fraud in Medicare. I don't believe that the private sector commercial plans are having that same level of problem. And so the general idea was, let's use the private sector, let's give people more choices, let's give people extra benefits, let's try and harness the private sector. And I would say that from the Republican perspective, the experiment was very difficult to do because you still had the distortionary huge regular fee-for-service program operating off to the side, which made it very difficult to compete. We are very pleased from Senator Grassley's perspective that this study in MIPA, thank you, Liz, is going to look at the geographic variation and trying to make some recommendations, because it is certainly Senator Grassley's view that there is a far, far better, there has to be a far, far better competition out there that will really harness the forces of competition to try and get some better efficiencies into Medicare, especially on the private plan side. And with that, I'll conclude.
Thank you very much, Kristen. And I guess we conclude once again the shocking, shocking truth that public policy with respect to Medicare is really screwed up. And thank you for, from BIPA to MIPA, it's been a difficult process. So a person and an entity that has to cope with this public policy and attempt to rationalize it in terms of provision of care and financing for this program is Simon Stevens, who's the CEO of Ovations, which is United Health's health and well-being company for seniors. It's the nation's largest seniors healthcare organization. It serves 9 million seniors and 1 in 5 Medicare beneficiaries across all the 50 states and territories. Ovations is the national market leader in Medicare supplement, Medicare Advantage, special needs plans, and Medicare Part D. It also provides hospice programs, employer retiree health plans, state-based Medicaid long-term care, and Evercare chronic disease management. Before joining United Health, Simon served as the British Prime Minister Tony Blair's health policy director and senior policy advisor at 10 Downing Street, and therefore has interesting insights into how other countries grapple with these similar kinds of problems with respect to public policy and health care. And he has also 20 years of leadership experience in healthcare policy and management, having run healthcare operations now in the U.S., in Asia, and Europe, in both the public and private sectors. So, Simon, welcome.
Thanks, Susan, and thanks to Health Affairs. As I always say, you can tell my accent is from the very north of Minnesota, where United Health Group is headquartered. Let me just start with a disclaimer. It's certainly true that I do run the largest Medicare health plan, but I have got two kind of perspectives that mean that I'm not here particularly to advocate for MA right or wrong. The first is that half of our revenues come from the original part of Medicare, traditional Medicare, and half from MA, so we get to see both sides of the equation and have got a sense of the strengths and weaknesses of both parts of the program. And the second caveat or disclaimer I should enter is that we took a deliberate decision some while ago not to be a major participant in private fee-for-service. So private fee-for-service is under 10% of the Medicare Advantage services that we run. So if you're looking for a pure defender of private fee-for-service, then I'm afraid I'm not your guy. However, what I will do is just try and think briefly about three questions. The first, which is, I think, raised in Brian and Bob's paper, what is Medicare Advantage for? What is it good for? The second is to then think about some of the distributional effects that changing Medicare Advantage rates, as Liz has just indicated, is likely to happen, some of the distributional considerations that need to be taken into account. And then thirdly, just try and locate this debate about Medicare Advantage in the broader context of a discussion about the future of Medicare as a whole. So, on the first question then, what is Medicare Advantage good for? I think we can conclusively answer that on at least three variables, MA is providing some benefit. There's a perfectly legitimate debate about whether it's the best way of providing these attributes or these gains, but I think it's pretty clear that MA is providing at least these three things, and then there's a debate about the fourth. The first is that I think it's pretty unequivocal that MA, by virtue of its funding structure, is providing additional benefits and reduced cost sharing compared to fee-for-service Medicare. There's no doubt that that's the case, and most of the extra dollars that plans get for their MA rates are used to reduce the cost sharing that would otherwise exist in the traditional fee-for-service program. I'll come on and talk about this a bit more in a moment. The second thing that I think is pretty clear is that judged against fee-for-service variation geographically, MA serves to improve the fairness of Medicare dollars deployed across the country, in that, by and large, in the high-cost parts of the country, MA is providing services at lower cost than traditional Medicare. That's certainly true in a place like Miami, for example. The flip side of that is that in low fee-for-service parts of the country, MA is generally drawing resources in to those parts of the country. So it is having some leveling effect on the distribution of Medicare resources across the country. The third thing that I think we can also conclude is that in at least some areas, some high-cost areas of the country, Medicare Advantage, particularly in its more coordinated incarnation, the network-based MA plans, are more efficient than the fee-for-service delivery system itself and therefore are contributing to cost containment. And one of the interesting things I think that was drawn out, we've seen from MedPAC, is that there clearly are efficiency differences between different types of Medicare Advantage plan. If you look at the cost of providing the underlying Medicare AB benefit, you see that, according to MedPAC, HMO Medicare Advantage plans are doing that for 99 cents on the dollar. So slightly less than what it costs traditional Medicare, as compared with private fee-for-service plans that are doing that for somewhere between 107 and 108 cents on the dollar. What you then get over and above the basic AB are the extra payments that are used for the extra benefits and reduced cost sharing that I talked about earlier. But this difference in the underlying efficiency of the provision of the AB benefit between network-based Medicare Advantage versus the non-networked part of Medicare is quite striking. So those three, I think, are pretty clear. The fourth question, where I think there is still a debate to be had and where probably you would say that the potential is there, even if it is not demonstrated in every case, is that I do believe that managed Medicare has the potential to improve the quality of care and reduce disparities. And there is some evidence that that is happening in at least some cases. If you look, for example, at the uptake of clinical preventive services in the Medicare Advantage population compared with the fee-for-service population, you can see that, say, in the case of mammography, there was 60% uptake in MA versus a 46% uptake in fee-for-service. In the case of colorectal cancer screening, 70% in MA versus 58% in fee-for-service without MedSup. So there is some evidence of that. So I think the answer to the question, what is MA good for, is it is providing additional benefits and reduced cost sharing. It is improving the geographical fairness of the use of resources across Medicare. It is, in at least some areas, improving the efficiency and containing costs relative to the traditional fee-for-service program, particularly in network-based HMO, coordinated care plans, and there is the potential, at least, to improve the quality and reduce disparities. So that would be, I think, a set of considerations right up. The second topic, however, that I think then flows from that and links to the comment that Liz made is if Medicare Advantage rates are going to come down, what are some of the things that policymakers need to take into account through that process? And I think here the devil will firmly be in the detail. The first point, of course, is that there are at least four different groups of people who will be affected as MA rates come down. There are the beneficiaries, there are the providers, there are employers, and there are states. Let me do those in more or less reverse order. Providers. As Kristen mentioned, there is clearly some form of cost shift going on between private and public payers. And so to the extent that rates come down for private payers, that is likely to lead to pressure on provider payments, at least in some parts of the country. In the case of employers, it's noteworthy, and I think this is a point that Marcia made in her paper, there have been increases in the employer usage of group Medicare Advantage over the last several years. And although that still represents a small proportion of MA in total, nevertheless, particularly for public sector employers, state, city governments, that is one route through which they are responding to the retiree healthcare pressures which they're facing. So anything that made that option more difficult for them would lead to further pressure on employers, including public sector employers. the geographical point we've already talked about. So the most important distributional consequences of changing MA rates will be felt by beneficiaries. And of course, the counterfactual to being in MA is being in fee-for-service with either MedSup and Part D or potentially Medicaid or retiree health coverage. And as we all know, traditional Medicare by itself in its 1966 incarnation leaves beneficiaries exposed to very significant out-of-pocket costs. There is no cap on out-of-pocket spending, and in total, under half of a beneficiary's medical and long-term care spending is funded through the traditional Medicare program. So compared with the situation where two-thirds of Medicare Advantage HMO plans are offering zero premium plans, in other words, beneficiaries who choose an MA plan no longer have to pay a MedSup or a Part D plan premium, there is clearly the potential for quite significant extra costs being imposed on those beneficiaries. Lewin estimated that that would constitute a $74 billion cost shift from the taxpayer to beneficiaries over 10 years if rates were set at 100% of fee-for-service. And within the beneficiary group, there are some subgroups that I think policymakers should be particularly concerned about. We know that whereas for people earning over $40,000 a year, retirees earning over $40,000 a year, 13% choose Medicare Advantage, whereas for people earning between $10,000 and $20,000 a year, 21% choose Medicare Advantage. And the position is even more stark amongst some other sections of the Medicare population. Amongst African Americans enrolled in Medicare Advantage, 69% have incomes of under $20,000, and for Hispanic beneficiaries in Medicare Advantage, that is 75% who have incomes under $20,000, compared with 43% for white beneficiaries. And among low-income active choosers, i.e. people who don't have Medicaid or don't have employer-retiree coverage, 41% of African Americans are choosing Medicare Advantage, 57% of Hispanics, compared with 31% of white beneficiaries. So there is a form of protection, of income protection, embedded in Medicare Advantage that as rates come down, policymakers are going to have to be very thoughtful about how that affects not just beneficiaries, but also employers and providers. So distribution of consequences is important. But the third and last thing I just wanted to say was this debate about MA, it seems to me, has to be located in a much broader debate, which we welcome and want to contribute to, about what we do about the overarching pressures in the Medicare program itself. We all know the figures, Medicare spending going to double over the next decade or so, beneficiaries up by 10 million, higher share of tax take, meaning that either costs are going to have to come down or taxes are going to have to come up or beneficiary contributions are going to be raised. Those are really the three essential, some combination of those three program choices. And so when you think about the Medicare program as a whole, I see kind of two stereotypical positions which are advanced. One is that Medicare is the innocent victim of all kinds of pathologies in the delivery system that if only they could be sorted out, then 1965 fee-for-service Medicare would be able to continue unabated in all its glory. The alternative is that Medicare is really the villain and that by virtue of its fee-for-service payment structure, its siloed funding streams, the absence of provider networks, it is incapable of keeping up with the changes that are required and generating efficiency through the system. Now, seen against those kind of two stereotypes, it seems to me that policymakers might want to reflect on the fact that once you've dealt with the rate issue, Medicare Advantage per se has some design features that may arguably be regarded as superior to those of 1965-style Medicare. Certainly, MA manages to combine fee-for-service, to overcome the fee-for-service incentive whereby volume is incentivized over quality and efficiency. It manages to combine the A, B, and D funding streams into one holistic unit of resource, needs adjusted for each beneficiary. By virtue of provider networks, it provides a framework within which providers can be incentivized through more sophisticated pay-performance approaches to raise quality and efficiency. And the effect of competition between plans has the potential, if structured properly, to ensure a dynamic updating process for benefit design rather than the rather stickier process of Congress itself having to periodically decide how benefits should change. So there are certain design features in fee-for-service Medicare that we should take seriously. Two final points. Brian made the point that fee-for-service could potentially take the lead on controversial reforms. That may be true. I hope that in some ways is true. However, I think Kristen illustrated with the DME example that often, in fact, that tends to be rather difficult. And so it's also possible that MA legitimized through consumer choice may be politically an easier bridgehead to reforming parts of Medicare than attempting a full frontal attack on the delivery system in legislation itself. And finally then, part of what's driving this is a perfectly legitimate hunt for dollars, the pay-fors, to do other things that need doing in the healthcare system, whether it's SCHIP or whether it's sorting out the doctor payment mechanism or wider health reform. And all I would conclude there by saying is, remember there are also very big opportunities in the traditional part of Medicare that should be part of this discussion. It is clear, for example, that probably about double the savings from MA reductions would be available from improving care coordination and primary care across the traditional part of Medicare, and probably triple the savings that are being talked about out of MA rates would be available by changing the payment structure to doctors and hospitals inside fee-for-service Medicare as compared with making changes in MA. So, in summary, thank you again, Susan. I do think we can conclude, as I say, that MA is providing extra benefits, that it is improving geographical fairness, and that at least in some parts of the country it's improving cost containment. I do think that we need to be very careful about the distributional consequences, particularly for poorer and minority beneficiaries, as rates come down. And I do think that we need to put this debate about MA inside the wider debate about how we advance Medicare reform as a whole. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Simon. And I want to say thank you from Health Affairs to the Atlantic Philanthropies, which has given us support to publish these papers and bring you this debate today. So what have we heard from our speakers? First of all, we heard from Marcia Gold that the Medicare Advantage Program, whatever we thought it was when it was created in its current form in 2003, is changing fast. And Congress in particular needs to decide very quickly what the point of it is, since we don't know at the moment what we're getting or what we're buying, and arguably should know that. Brian Dowd shared many points with us, but a very important point he did leave us with is that overpaying for any Medicare product is probably a very wasteful and bad idea. And as Simon said just a moment ago, I guess it depends on our perspective about whether traditional Medicare is the villain or the savior of everything. In any case, overpaying for any Medicare product is wasteful, and there's obviously considerable evidence that we are probably overpaying for Medicare in the fee-for-service realm as well. So we better think of some mechanisms where we can deal with this broadly across both areas. Liz made the point that the choice available through Medicare Advantage has come at a very, very high price, that she quoted Uwe Reinhardt saying that we're in effect giving the Medicare Advantage plans tips on top of the basic service, but no apparent return at the moment. And nonetheless, there are many serious issues to be had with figuring out how to make all of this work better. And as she pointed out, Medicare has not been a particularly great business partner for the plans to work with as well. So considerable discussion now about attempt to answer Marcia's question, what should these payments look like, what are we paying for anyway, and how should all of this be structured? Then we heard from Kristen that from the Republican perspective that there's a clear belief that Medicare fee-for-service is, in a way, a kind of a villain, that it is growing out of control, and that there continues to be hope that if Medicare could be moved to a more private sector basis, market forces could figure out some of the anomalies in the program and make everything a little bit more efficient. And then finally, as you've just heard, we heard Simon putting this into context that Medicare Advantage is indeed providing some benefit that we know of. There's debate over whether it has achieved its potential to improve quality of care and to reduce disparities, but that again, as we approach these issues going forward, we really have to ask the broader question, what do we do about Medicare overall, Medicare itself? I would just add that we know that we're about to enter into an even broader debate here, or at least it certainly looks that way with respect to health care reform. And Liz, Senator Baucus's white paper on this has taken up some of the themes that were talked about during the campaign and put forward by Senator, now President-elect Obama, to the effect that as we think about the whole movement toward universal coverage, there might be clear efforts, first of all, to expand Medicare to new populations, specifically those 55 to 64 years old, to enable them to buy into Medicare. But then in addition to that, that there might be a new public plan option available through insurance exchanges for all Americans. So whereas we might have been discussing these issues to date simply with respect to Medicare, Medicare traditional fee-for-service versus Medicare private plans, there's now the potential that we'll be talking about this in a much, much broader context with respect to an even bigger Medicare program or an even bigger public plan program. So I just wanted to start with you. How do you think Congress is going to weigh into take some of the issues that we've talked about today, private provision of services, the private financing under Medicare Advantage, in this larger context of perhaps a much bigger role for a public plan generally?
Well, that's a really good question, and I'm glad you brought up the larger debate because I think a lot of these issues are taking place right now in the context of thinking about broader healthcare reform, and I think that's at least at this point, what Congress would like to consider going forward is looking at the health system as a whole. That encompasses a lot of the issues that, that Simon brought up, certainly, and Brian, about the ways that we pay for care right now, not only in Medicare, but also in the commercial sector. So I hope that we get a chance to go down this road because certainly no one thinks our healthcare system right now is working very well, and there are a lot of things that could be done. You asked about a public plan option and the expansion of Medicare to the 55 to 64 population. As Senator Baucus envisioned this buy-in to Medicare, and that was specifically allowed just for this, the sort of near-retiree population, I think what he felt was that right now if you have a pre-existing condition, there might not be private sector options for you. And at least until we get to the point where we have a reformed healthcare system, there needs to be some place for these folks to go where even if you have had cancer or have high blood pressure or high cholesterol, you should be able to get care, and Medicare seemed a logical place to go, at least in the short term. I think that the long-term solution was, as he envisioned it, this national exchange that would include a public plan option as one of the choices. I think you have to be very careful how you design that and in going down that road to make sure that you don't end up with some of the same problems that you see in the Medicare Advantage program vis-a-vis the fee-for-service program. You can see creating an unlevel playing field on, you know, both at the national level between the private plans and the public program, and then between the national options and the state-based options. So a lot of these design elements in the white paper that was released 2 weeks ago were intentionally left blank, and I think were intended to be filled in as we go down the road of discussing reform. And so look forward to hearing from a lot of the folks in this audience about how best to fill in those policy questions and answer those policy questions. So I know that's a little bit vague, but it was intended to be that way.
Once again, we are shocked about that one as well. Thank you. Kristen, your perspective on this, because clearly on the Republican side, you are all watching what is being talked about now on the Democratic side in the Senate and elsewhere. How do you think these questions about the relative merits of private plans under Medicare versus the traditional fee-for-service system will be confronted in an environment where potentially there will be new public plan options broadly for the American public, possibly modeled after Medicare?
Generally, Republicans have concerns about public programs crowding out private sector options. And so certainly that was a concern during the SCHIP debate last year. So I think that our membership will look at whatever the proposals are and keep that in mind in terms of judging what they think about them. In terms of Medicare, I think the jury is still out on how those two efforts are going to be combined. It seems like kind of a heavy lift to be doing them all at the same time, although obviously we do have to do another Medicare bill next year.
And do you think, what is your bet as to how this will proceed? Would there be, obviously it's not necessarily the minority side which is going to be deciding these things, but with respect to a Medicare fix versus a broader set of reforms, do you have any sense of what the preference would be on the Republican side as to how to proceed?
I don't think we're going to be able to judge that, so I will leave that answer to Liz.
Liz?
How are we going to proceed on the two sets of bills?
Well, I think at this point, and you know, we're hoping that once the transition team gets up and running, that we'll have more regular contact and more close working relationship with the new administration or the incoming administration. And you know, I think, as Senator Baucus envisions it, it would be one large effort that all of these questions need to be answered together. I think it's getting harder and harder in healthcare to look at one piece of the puzzle without looking at the big picture. That it's hard to do small business health reform and try to make sure there are affordable options for small business without thinking about other larger market changes. It's harder to think about covering children without really thinking about what you do with the parents or where their parents get coverage. And in the same way, some of the delivery system reform changes that Senator Baucus thinks need to take place or need to start in Medicare, the value-based purchasing and a lot of the emphasis on primary care and care coordination, that a lot of that can be done through Medicare but have implications for the marketplace as a whole. And so I think at this point, as Senator Baucus sees it, this would be a larger effort and a single bill. But as Kristen pointed out, you know, not sure how far we can get, but we have to do a Medicare bill next year anyways. But I think for a lot of the providers in Medicare, when you're looking at making changes that significantly affect the way that they're paid, you'd like to also reassure them that that you're also covering the uninsured and taking off some of the burden of uncompensated care as well.
So since we can't foretell the future at this point, let's stick with a discussion then over the relative merits of private plans and Medicare versus some of the traditional fee-for-service. And, Marcia, it looked like you wanted to say something here.
Well, I actually wanted to say something on the more general point. It strikes me that, separate from the details, one of the interesting things that I would think has been learned as a result of the Medicare program is potentially the desirability of providing some buffer between the day-to-day decisions on how some of these issues get dealt with and the congressional process. In other words, Congress has an important role in setting up the policy framework, deciding what's important. But if you're going to run a program that actually runs, that has some predictability and stability, that understands how things work and sort of protects, I mean, from some of each interest and who's stronger and who wants what and who's the food fight there, it would be potentially useful to figure out some way that keeps the public and Congress in control of the goals, but has implementation slightly offline, whether for Medicare or for a private plan, that it can be a little bit more businesslike and stable.
Are you speaking in effect of the Federal Health Board type of proposal that Senator Daschle, now the nominee for HHS, has talked about?
That's possible, but I'm not an expert on which different boards could do it, but I think that's an example.
Brian?
Yeah, just a comment on that. I tend to be pretty hard on Congress in this area, and it's not because I don't respect the members of Congress. I do. It's just because I think Congress as an institution isn't set up to do some kinds of things, and I think micromanaging a health plan is one of the things it's not set up to do very well. So I agree with Marcia on that. But this is a tough area because There are sort of two criticisms that arise. One is, can one institution both offer a plan and run a competitive pricing system with multiple plans at the same time without favoring the plan that it offers? This is not unique to public sector problems. This was the same question we asked 20 years ago about large companies that offered a self-insured fee-for-service plan and then offered HMOs, and the HMOs were always wondering how they were, the employer was manipulating out-of-pocket premiums to either put healthier or sicker people into the self-insured plan. So it's an old problem, hasn't gone away, and I think it's one that Congress, you know, they're going to get hung either way they come down on it. Because if they try and separate the administration, then they're going to be charged for having a system that isn't accountable. But if they try and run it themselves, then they're going to get criticism based on past experience that says they're sort of inept. I don't know how this all should work itself out, except for the fact that I think that, as I said in the slides, I think that it is the beneficiary who is the best judge when they face a fair market test of what health plan features are worth what they cost and what features are not. And so if Congress wants to protect the DME industry from competition, it's okay with me as long as beneficiaries face the marginal out-of-pocket cost of a health plan that protects the DME industry from competition. But what I object to is Congress protecting the DME industry from competition and then protecting the fee-for-service plan from competition from plans that don't protect the DME industry from competition. And so I just want at some point me to face the marginal cost of these plan features, and I'll decide whether they're worth what they cost or not. Thank you.
Brian, you raised the prospect of potentially having a competitive bidding structure that positioned both the private plans against traditional fee-for-service. And as we know in this country, basically everybody believes in competition until it comes to their sector, at which point they decide it's a very bad idea. And in fact, efforts to have these competitive bidding procedures move forward under Medicare private plans have been derailed by those who feared the effects of competition. Let's ask ourselves whether you think it would be possible to construct that kind of a competitive bidding system, just given the politics of the situation. And then I'd like to hear Simon talk about that prospect as a company that, as you said, not only is coordinating a lot of the care under the traditional program, but also, in fact, offering Medicare Advantage plans. So.
Yes, of course, I think it's possible. Is this the point in the talk where we show our scars? I was on the technical assistance demo group when we were trying to do competitive pricing in Medicare in four different demo cities back in the mid to late 1990s. And what I saw in CMS was an absolute capability of running a competitive pricing system for Medicare. I mean, they have the, first of all, the core features of it are not that hard to administer. We've been doing it in the private sector for, as I said, I've been getting my health insurance that way for 28 years. We have CalPERS. We have all sorts of models out there to work on. And CMS did a great technical job on its part of the competitive pricing demonstration for Medicare.
You might want to share for the audience, many of whom perhaps did not live through that experience and doesn't have the scars to show for it, what happened.
Congress, at one point, Congress first mandated a competitive pricing demonstration in Medicare. Now, this was an HMO-only system, so that's a issue with the HMOs and a problem from my perspective, I suppose, as well as the industry's perspective. It was an HMO-only demo, but the benefit package, the standard benefit package on which plans bid, was not the entitlement benefit package, which is actually what I've been advocating. It was an enhanced benefit package. That was the market norm. So it included things like drug coverage in places like Denver, Phoenix, Kansas City. And what happened was we got to the point where bids were actually sent in Denver, and so there's a public record of how the bids came out. They were astonishingly lower. The plans submitted two prices, one for the entitlement benefit package and one for the community norm benefit package. The prices they submitted were astonishingly lower than the entitlement rates that were being paid in Denver at the time, and also, of course, for the enhanced package. But before any demonstration in any city could be implemented, the demos were stopped through congressional legislation by the local folks. This was a bipartisan effort, not laying the blame at either the Republicans or Democrats' feet. I'll leave it at that.
And out of concerns that the squeeze on providers would be so massive.
But also the plan sued, right?
Yes, right. The plan sued.
It wasn't just Congress. It was the plans trying to stop it.
Very much like DME, the courts play a role here as well. And so it was a judge in Denver that stopped that demo.
And again, some of the plans themselves were raising concerns about this.
Oh, yes.
Competitive,
yeah,
right?
Well, as you say, competitive pricing, you cannot expect that to be popular with the sellers.
Right. Right. So thinking about applying that model today, Simon, how would you react to that?
Well, wildly enthusiastic, of course. Now, to be serious. I'd say three things. First, of course, we already have competitive bidding in MA. We bid against benchmarks. Those plans that are more efficient have more rebate dollars that they can put into extra benefits or improve care, which in turn should improve their competitiveness in the market. And, I mean, let's not forget, MA, at least, is highly competitive. There are, on average, 35 competitor plans in every county across the country. So there's no shortage of competition, given the way the setup is currently structured. Part D, we have a different type of competitive bidding. The difference between, obviously, the two is that in Part D, all of the participants, all of the providers of Part D are involved in the competition. There's no traditional part of Medicare, no publicly provided alternative that is outside the structure of competition. So you could argue that is a fairer approach than what I think you were perhaps hinting at, which is that you would have a sort of bifurcated competitive bidding process in which for private plans in Medicare, there would be a new type of competitive bidding, but in the traditional part of Medicare, there would just be the old monopsony pricing.
No, I think the model was really what Brian was talking about, which is that everybody would.
So then my question back, which I think is an intellectually very interesting idea, I'm just trying to struggle to think a bit how in practice the public part of this participates in the bid. In that if the public fee-for-service version can then just impose its winning bid through its monopsony pricing power, I'm not quite sure how there's a competition. So are you saying that you would move away from administered pricing in the fee-for-service part of the system? Because if you didn't do that, then you haven't got competitive bidding.
Brian?
If I understand the question, the development of a fee-for-service bid technically is fairly trivial. Marcia, maybe you can tell me. They certainly used to publish average fee-for-service spending in every county in the U.S., and at the moment that could be the fee-for-service bid. Now, I think your issue, if I understand it, is that is not that part of it. It's the pricing of healthcare services in fee-for-service Medicare. And so there the question is whether that has, I pointed out in the slide, whether the good points and bad points are things that are so good or so bad that we want to do something about them. And so I am concerned about provider market concentration.
Right.
And I think the first best solution to that is to enforce antitrust laws. I think if we have situations where, for some reason that maybe I don't understand, we aren't enforcing the antitrust laws, or we just don't have good competition in the local provider market, I'd be delighted if the Ovation products can do something about that, but I'd be open to the suggestion that bilateral monopoly in the form of the federal government's pricing power in some market areas might be a first best, second best solution for beneficiaries and for the programs in those market areas. So I want to say I think we want to think carefully before we just wade in and make kind of wholesale restrictions or changes on the way fee-for-service Medicare sets healthcare service prices.
Marcia.
Yeah. If I understood you, you were saying that one of the advantages of the government-run Medicare program is that it can get pricing from providers, and that was a concern for you with the level playing field. And it strikes me, but that is an advantage. That's what government has. Its disadvantage is it doesn't have the flexibility. And it doesn't seem to me that one would want to even that out. That's what government can bring to the table. And so, you know, the question I have, I think the idea of having access standards, and it's a good one. It hasn't been historically a problem for traditional Medicare. Basically, all doctors and hospitals participated in the program. I think there is a problem now in the traditional program because of some of the politics around physician payments. And maybe this is a reason to keep some of the politics a little further out. You don't have very good payments for the care that primary care physicians in Medicare pay to regular physicians. And I think access could be becoming a problem. But if some of that politics were out and there were access standards, Medicare might have to rejuggle, pay less a little bit for those procedures and more for other things. But I think that if industry is going to compete, it has to compete understanding what the government brings to the table when it's a payer and what the industry brings to the table.
Let me try to bring this back a little bit from the more ethereal discussions about reinventing these markets to a very practical set of concerns. What should Congress do in the year ahead? None of you had particularly endearing things to say about private fee-for-service plans. And Simon, you even noted that United had made the decision to stay out of them. Kristen, you gave us some background on how those plans came about in the first place. And we do know that the Right to Life movement was actually not particularly opposed to some of the changes that were made in MIPA affecting the private fee-for-service plans because the movement appeared to believe that those plans had not lived up to their expectations either. So what should happen with private fee-for-service plans going forward? Kristen, you start, and then Liz, I'd like to hear your perspective on that.
Well, in truth, I spent hours and hours in a room with National Right to Life working out the compromise that was done in MIPA, as did Liz's colleague Sean at a certain point. And I don't speak for Right to Life, obviously, but they, I think, believed very strongly that they had never intended for of the 45 plans in a given area that were competing that, you know, 40 of them be private fee-for-service plans. So that I think Right to Life understood that the product had gotten away. They also, no one ever expected these plans to be sort of zero premium plans. The Right to Life expectation was that people would be willingly paying lots of extra, potentially, premium dollars for the privilege of not having to be in a network. And so the product just never worked out the way really Right to Life intended it. And again, I don't speak for them, but certainly the way it was never expected to have worked out in that fashion. Obviously, it was an extraordinarily good business opportunity. From Senator Grassley's point of view, he's very grateful that we have private plan options for beneficiaries in rural parts of Iowa, that those folks would simply not have other options. And so from his point of view, I think he would prefer to see how MIPA works out, because as we all know, in 2 years, in areas in which there are coordinated care plans, the private fee-for-service plans are going to have to transition and get networks. Now, my guess is a lot of them will simply exit the market because it is very expensive. Simon can talk about this more than I can. Obviously, he's the business guy, and I'm not, but it's very expensive to get networks. So from that perspective, I think Senator Grassley's preference would be, let's wait and see how that plays out in terms of the private fee-for-service plans. You know, in terms of the rest of the market, again, I really strongly would beg to differ with Marcia about this idea that it's a fair competition if you're 80% of the Medicare market, or 77 or whatever it is right now, and you get to use price controls to be the competition for your product. Gosh, how is that really actually a competition? And so, again, from Senator Grassley's perspective, any kind of competitive bidding structure that gets worked out, I think our staff will be instructed to try and figure out a competition that really will be a fair competition. And again, over time, Liz pointed out that politically over time there were the mezzanine floors and the rest of them. You know, in BVA in 1997 or 8, whichever year that was, so many years ago, I'm such a fossil, you know, the idea was you had the low-payment counties and you had the high-payment counties, and we were supposed to be on this glide path to try and bring those things together. And we have yet to have that happen, and that's a political problem. And there's, you know, from the staff perspective, there is nothing we can do about those kinds of politics. And I know the staff has worked, and I haven't been on the Hill very long, but I know Liz has worked diligently, and my colleagues have worked diligently to try and fix these things. But truly, the major problem in our country is the underlying, what's going on underlyingly with healthcare services. And frankly, the Medicare Advantage program is really just a reflection of that. You guys know the Dartmouth Atlas. Everybody reads it. We all cite it. And we've been citing it for God only knows how many years. We all know there's massive variation. We all know we have too many specialists. Medicare, frankly, fee-for-service is leading the charge in why there are so many specialists. You make a lot more money. I am so sorry. We're a capitalist economy. I'd like to make a lot more money, too, and if I were a doc, I'd go do the thing that you make a lot more money and you work fewer hours. Let's review, as my husband once said when I switched job. Fewer hours, more pay. Fewer hours, more pay. Okay, so, you know, I mean, you all know this. I don't think we should be blaming Medicare Advantage for all of these problems, and I'm going to stop now.
Okay. Economics 101 from Kristen. Liz.
Well, gosh, what can I add to that? And the original question was, what should happen to private fee-for-service?
Yes.
I want to get back to that. And, you know, frankly, in my own personal opinion, private fee-for-service has been a black eye on the program. That's where you've seen a lot of the abuses. That's where you've seen the plans taking advantage of the money that's on the table and get in, I think, quickly and try to make as much money before Congress figures it out and decides to take it away. These plans are not managing benefits. They're not providing the type of care coordination that I think was the reason that a lot of the Republicans wanted an expansion of private plans in Medicare during MMA. So they've not, I think, lived up to, I think, the better aspects of what you could expect from private plans in Medicare. And, you know, it's also, I think, crowded the field. It's made it, they've created more competition for the plans that are doing the sort of things that we want to see out of the Medicare Advantage program, which is care coordination with an integrated benefit and, you know, bringing greater efficiency to Medicare. So it's been harder, I think, for some of the HMOs and some of the PPOs to get their message across about the value that they bring because they are competing against, I think, what's become a black mark on the private plan option under Medicare. And not only that, while it's brought choice, it's also brought a lot of problems for beneficiaries who may or may not know whether a doctor is going to be able to take or wants to take these beneficiaries when they go into the office, that there's been access and a lot of complaints. There have been a lot of complaints on the part of providers. We know some hospitals have just refused to take private fee-for-service beneficiaries altogether, and so access has not been guaranteed. So I think that, you know, that being said, we tried to reverse some of those anomalies in what was included in MIPA. There may be a role for employer-sponsored plans, that these do seem to be a legitimate option for employer retiree programs or employer-sponsored retiree programs, but we're subsidizing them with government dollars, and we're doing that implicitly rather than explicitly. If we believe that there is a value to having this option available to employers that want to continue providing retiree coverage, we shouldn't be necessarily subsidizing them inadvertently through the payment system, that we should make an explicit decision that this is something we want to do and that the government is willing to pay X amount rather than this convoluted payment system that we have that is subsidizing these plans, but without making an explicit decision to do so.
Quick comment from Marcia, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience.
Yeah, just on the group plans, I mean, there is your question about what should people worry about now. I'm not sure this is a legislative issue or an administrative issue, but partly because the private fee-for-service plans were so attractive to employer groups and that disadvantaged HMOs and PPOs, CMS indicated it would allow these sort of private fee-for-service arrangements for an employer group as long as half of the beneficiaries were in the local areas. And I read newsletters just a week ago, and people are still encouraging those. So in terms of Liz's comments, those transitions could be expensive, And I think people need to have a handle on whether or not this is what people want to be doing with Medicare's program. If it's an explicit dealing with employer retiree coverage, it makes sense to deal with it more explicitly.
Let's take questions from the audience. I'd encourage you to introduce yourself by name and affiliation. I believe we also have some microphones right here. Let's take a question right here for starters.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Trish Niemore. I'm with the Center for Medicare Advocacy. Every person on the panel has referred to coordinated care one way or the other, and I think that is what we think managed care brings as value. The Center for Medicare Advocacy believes there should be coordinated care in the private, in the traditional Medicare program, but I find it very curious that there are no requirements for care coordination, for coordinated care plans. MIPA included them for special needs plans. CMS has just recently issued regulations that outline some care coordination requirements for special needs plans. NCQA is just now receiving comments on measures for special needs plans for care coordination. And I think it's shocking that in all of the sessions that anybody ever goes to about Medicare Advantage, nobody talks about the lack of information about what kind of care coordination actually is happening in MA plans and what value it's providing to beneficiaries. And it's just an underlying assumption and a kind of given. And we like those plans better than private fee-for-service because they do that, but we really don't know what they're doing.
And, so Marcia, you made the point that the program is not being run in a way that has this kind of stewardship or transparency. So what should be done?
Well, I think there's two ways to do that, and there's some debate. With special needs plans, I think there's been very much interested in having very specific requirements. With general MA, the question is whether the debate will be, I think my sense is definitely there needs to be more performance measures. There needs to be more ways of monitoring whether, in fact, mechanisms are in place to coordinate care and they're improving care. The debate and the question will be how specific one should get in telling each organization how exactly they should do it, because markets are different in certain areas. But I think the comment is an important one, and it's a lot easier to control money than it is to change delivery. And I think whatever can be done to encourage the focus on that and improving care from the point of view of the beneficiary, that the better.
Simon, how is Ovations tackling this question of care coordination, especially within the special needs plans, but more broadly?
Sure. Well, let me just give you a kind of concrete example. I was down recently with one of our new members, out with one of our advanced nurse practitioners down in North Carolina, and looking at some of the programs that we're running down there. We visited a woman who had just turned 65, new to Medicare. She had congestive heart failure, COPD, depression, and she effectively could walk about 10 to 15 yards. Her daughter, who'd been her primary carer, they'd had a bust up. She had six different doctors. We went into her kitchen. She had around 30 bottles of different prescription drugs on the kitchen table. She was completely confused as to how they were interacting. She'd just been discharged from the hospital 3 weeks before with a persistent nosebleed, which the nurse who I was with was immediately able to see was a consequence of polypharmacy issues, medicine interactions between the prescribing. So what we do in that situation is actually convene a case conference of her physicians, do a health risk assessment, and then make sure that the social services and the broader home support that she's going to need are in place. I myself attempted to fix her her electronic stair lift, which was broken, which meant she couldn't go upstairs. I failed
you
in that task.
You are a versatile
CEO. I failed in that task, and when I got back to back to the office, one of our legal lot told me, thank goodness you failed, because if she'd then sort of broken down halfway up the stairs, think what a lot of trouble you'd be in now. So this noble effort fortunately ended in no result on my part. But on the part of the nurse practitioner, there is clearly a group of Medicare beneficiaries for whom the current system works incredibly badly. And the kind of programs that we and others run, I think, are the kind of programs that are only possible when you've actually got responsibility for a member for a year or for a period of time, and the ability to blend the resources that are being made available from different sources
so for your competitors who are not doing a good job at care coordination, could you all live with performance standards? And should there be a more explicit holding all of you to a higher standard?
So certainly, as Marcia said, in the special needs plans, you know, we're the biggest operator of special needs plans. Our perspective is that the S has to mean something. Our special needs plans should be special. So we supported, in fact, we positively advocated that standards should be set as to what the clinical, that there should be discrete clinical care models for those plans. So I certainly agree with that. However, I think kind of two other thoughts. One is we've got to be a bit careful about mandating the precise shape of the clinical model when, of course, actually part of what you're paying private plans to do is to kind of experiment and learn from their mistakes and get it right over time. And so if you just try and say across the whole industry the answer is X, chances are the answer won't be X. And certainly if we hadn't have had, in the case of our Evercare group, 20 years of kind of learning and experimentation to refine what we're doing, then if we just kind of settled on the answer as it appeared after year 3 or year 4, we'd have made a big mistake. So I think there's something about standardizing measurement, perhaps rather than specifying the detail of the way a model works. And related to that, I would say I think there is a case for an overarching pay-for-performance approach, but that should span the whole of Medicare. That should be a level playing field pay-for-performance mechanism that works inside fee-for-service and inside MA.
Brian, quick comment?
Yes, thank you, Susan. I think your question about your competitors is right along the lines I was thinking, and so it's almost inconceivable for me to believe that these activities we've just heard described don't save more than a dollar for every dollar you spend. If that's the case, why do we need to mandate anything? Why do we need to regulate anything? I might even go so far as to say, why do we even need to report anything? Won't rational health plans engage in an investment that saves more than a dollar for every dollar that you spend? A question for the woman who asked. A question for everybody.
If it were to be happening that way, wouldn't we have seen some result to that effect?
Yes, so maybe it's not true, or maybe it's the case that it costs more, but beneficiaries aren't willing to pay the extra cost out of their pocket. Now, I want to distinguish not willing versus not able, because if it's a question of not able and it's an income distribution problem, we need to address it that way, not just mandate the benefit for everybody. Or maybe we don't have the system set up so that that kind of thing, innovation, happens.
Interesting question. Liz?
Can I say, I think this goes back to the competing priorities, that different members of Congress have different priorities for what they think private plans are bringing to the program. And some would like, and those who were in control at the time the Medicare Modernization Act was written, wanted private plans in the program for the sake of just having private plans, regardless of how much we paid them, and, you know, without any standards or requirements there. And that's what we got, that if it turns out if you pay a lot of money, and build it and they will come, and without setting any standards, you know, there they are. And so I think we're now entering an era where we are going to be looking at, you know, what is it we want from these plans, and how much are we willing to pay for that? And I think we're sort of the pendulum is shifting back to the other direction, where I think there will be more accountability and greater standards. I do worry about building in a government requirement and standardizing, you know, exactly what we want these programs to look like without thinking about, you know, what they may want to look like, you know, 5 years down the line. So, you know, that's the balancing act that I'm sure we'll, you know, have many discussions with Kristen and her colleagues about, and, you know, on both sides of the aisle and across the Capitol, trying to figure out what that should look like going forward. But I think the pendulum is clearly shifting back in the other direction.
We could clearly keep this conversation going for quite a long time, but I'm going to move to some other questions here. Let's take a couple of questions here, and then we'll move over to this side.
Gary Christofferson, former CMS senior advisor. Back in the mid-1980s, a fellow by the name of Jim Doherty, former head of GWHAA, and Brian and I were talking about this earlier, said we had a long set of conversations about the future of HMOs and similar type of vehicles. And what we both agreed was, A, cost the same or less, B, high quality, C, good access in terms of that, and three, there would be this coordination of care you all have talked about there. And what my counsel to Jim at that time was, we were at a point where you could have the best of worlds or the worst of worlds. And the question was to essentially the association at that time, which had a different membership than it does today in its new iteration there, is how do we make sure it is the best of worlds? So you all have alluded to that to some extent in some of your comments, but how do we make sure that happens, by the way, not just for the traditional HMO types, the fee-for-service, if they exist, the private fee-for-service, and traditional fee-for-service, that exists in all three parts.
Marcia?
Well, I think that's why I was suggesting that we need to decide, at least at this iteration, given where all the votes are, what we want the private plan option to be within what Medicare should be, set it up in a way that is relatively less politicized, and get some good performance measures and make it, and let's see what's happening so that we can judge whether we're getting what we want. But we didn't do that, and I think we saw what happened as a result.
Kristen?
Well, I kind of like to go back to my observation when I started, which was the part of the reason that the earlier, I've worked in the HMO industry, managed care industry, pretty much my entire life, which is maybe not a good thing. But, you know, people didn't want to be in tightly managed HMOs. You have to look at what the consumers actually want. And so I think in all of our discussion, we're having the usual top-down what we think people should have discussion as opposed to what the beneficiaries will actually want. And that concerns me a little bit. The reason, and what's interesting to me is, okay, back when you were talking to the GHAA president, the discussion was all around very tightly managed HMOs, staff model, group model. Okay, fast forward. Then the rest of the insurance industry said, wow, these are kind of a cool model. We can sort of pretend we're like that. And what they did instead was gatekeepers. Everyone hated it, and those fell apart. Now we're back to PPOs. So instead, what we've now started talking about is the whole medical home, which is really a lot like what the original staff and group model HMOs were like, except now we're talking about it less as an insurance model and more as a delivery system model, and everybody's trying to figure out how do we get everybody to look like Geisinger, Mayo, you know, the few models that are out there, which have been around forever, and if it was easy to do them, the entire country would have them. I find this discussion really interesting that way, and I worry that as we talk about these issues, we really are doing a kind of top-down, this is what people should have. The coordinated care demos in Medicare on the fee-for-service side, 1 in 15 actually was cost-effective. The rest failed. It is very difficult to enforce coordination onto a system that is not already integrated. And certainly the MA plans are probably finding this because they're doing their best, but the PPO products, frankly, it's hard. And the fee-for-service side, the demos weren't particularly successful. Maybe, and I do not do that part of our program, so I am not expert in this, but it is possible they weren't set up as well as they could have been. But nonetheless, it is very difficult to try and coordinate people who would maybe rather just be left alone. And certainly the providers would really just be left alone.
Let's take a question here, and then we'll move to a couple other on this side and then close it out.
David Rabin, Georgetown University. Both pre-2003 and post-2003, the evidence indicated that private plans had cherry picking, that they had better selection, one. And pre-2003, people shifted from private plans back into the public plan, Medicare, when they were sick. They either were pushed or chose to see that was a better benefit for them. So my question is, How could we set up a situation with private plans, knowing that risk-related premiums are very, very difficult to implement fairly, such that we can be assured that there would be public responsibility and equity with public plans competing with private plans?
Brian?
Well, I'll just take a shot and turn it over to Martha, who may know a lot more about the current state of risk adjustment than I do. I mean, my sense is that I've heard a couple of criticisms, but my sense is that the current system is not working all that badly, and the plans seem to like it okay, in part because they designed it, but it had to be budget neutral, and in part because it allows them to collect diagnosis data from someplace other than the hospital, which they were trying to keep people out of all that time. So, but Marcia, you see.
Yeah, no, I mean, unlike pre-2003, there is a more broad-based risk adjustment that's been fully implemented and should be more budget neutral in the years ahead. So it's a little better. I think it's still an issue because risk adjustment is just inherently hard, and there's always those small percentages of people who use a lot of care. And so there's still some potential for gaming. Certainly the growth of special needs plans, which deals with high-cost people, has put a lot of pressure on the risk adjustment system to be good. And it's a little bit worrisome. I'm glad now that there are more requirements for what special needs plans should do, because I think there was just too much money on the table there. It's an ongoing concern, and it's one reason for trying to get a little bit better public information on it. I would love to be able to see more disenrollment rates reported by types of plans, by states, by reasons and length of enrollment or prior use. I mean, you can't get that data publicly ever because there are privacy concerns with individuals. But as far as I can tell, there is absolutely no reason why some aggregated data at a fairly micro level couldn't be constructed by CMS and put out periodically so that we'd have some more ability to look at it or even to do our own analyses on those issues.
Simon?
Yeah, no, I would agree with Marcia. I think curious incentives changed dramatically after the introduction of risk adjustment, and that was a big step forward, and it made possible the fact that the member I was talking about down in North Carolina, we were able to kind of actively go out and seek to serve people like that without just running into the sand and going out of business. So risk adjustment has clearly made a big difference and is a big improvement on what went before. But that's not the only tool in the CMS armamentarium around this stuff. CMS also get to oversee the structure of benefit design to ensure that there aren't attributes of that which might lead to risk selection. They get to approve and control marketing materials and other aspects of the process. So the powers to influence these types of behavior exist in current legislation, and I think the consensus is generally are working rather better than what went before.
I just say, I think the consensus maybe it's working better than before. I just personally don't know what's happening. There really has been no information put out about turnover in enrollment. I can't get it for anything, and so there may or may not be problems, but they're relatively invisible, which is a problem itself.
CMS will be publishing turnover data over the course of this coming year.
But that's very gross. I think they're going to publish some, and it's an important first step.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about is much more refined indicators that we can interpret more easily, not just how many switch each year, but how many switch right away so we think they're confused,
right.
How many switch right after a hospitalization,
right.
By market level, so we can see if there are particular problems in particular markets.
It's actually going to be more specific than that, Marcia, because it's going to be linked to the new commission's payment structure that they put out. So they're actually going to be supplying plans with lists of people who are switching from different parts of the program and when they're doing it.
So Marcia, you're going to have lots of fodder to publish more papers in health affairs. Let's take these last two questions, and we'll close it out.
Okay, thank you. I'm Nora Super with Kaiser Permanente. I had a comment and a question. One is just a comment, and I don't think Kristen's going to necessarily disagree with me, but I'm on the physician side of Kaiser. I just mentioned that because I work with a lot of large physician group practices, and I would say Mayo and Geisinger might say that there aren't a lot more of them just because all the incentives aren't aligned correctly in the fee-for-service system of Medicare, not necessarily because consumers prefer it to be that way. And then my question, though, is that this is a very helpful dialogue and very thoughtful, and I appreciate that, a Medicare Advantage. My concern is in the coming up to the election, most of the talk about Medicare Advantage on both sides, the Republican and the Democratic nominee, as well as some discussions before, were often just about Medicare Advantage being a way to pay for things as we go in to next year. And I think, Liz, you mentioned that, you know, it might be caught up in everything that we talk about. So I'm wondering, and I know you can't speak for your House colleagues, but for both Liz and Kristen, if you think that there will be a lot of thoughtful policy discussion in Congress around how we think about Medicare Advantage. You talked about relying a lot on MedPAC, or if it will be used more as a way to pay for other policy priority.
Well, I guess we always hope that there's going to be thoughtful dialogue going on Capitol Hill, and whether or not that actually ends up being true is, you know, another question. And certainly when you're talking about a large package that encompasses a lot of different priorities, you know, I hope that we can keep that thoughtful dialogue as thoughtful as it should be. And that is why we end up relying quite a bit on outside experts, including MedPAC. So, you know, we are somewhat dependent on outside researchers, because sometimes we just don't know what the answer is. And if you leave it up to Congress, it's going to be made based on, you know, who's going to win and who's going to lose in that equation. And I don't know that that's the best policymaking. So we look forward to hearing about, you know, better ways of doing things. And we can always hope that, that we make the right decision in the end. In terms of whether it's used to, you know, pay for other things, I guess, you know, if there are offsets to be had, any changes that we make certainly could be reinvested into the program, and whether that's used to reinvest into the Medicare program or, you know, for larger health reform purposes, just depends on the size of the package and what else is on the table. But, you know, I don't think there was a lot of disagreement that the program is overpaid right now. So, you know, as a matter of our duty to taxpayers, I think we should be looking at those changes at this point. And where the reinvestment is made just depends on whatever else is on the table. But we should, as a starting point, I think, look more closely at the program and its responsibility to beneficiaries and to taxpayers.
Okay, a final question here from Tom.
Tom Miller, AEI. Usually when we start these discussions, you begin with kind of the global assumption that we can't keep doing what we're currently doing. We can't afford it. It's unsustainable. Yet we have all these other things we want to do in the healthcare program. These are all the wonderful benefits. We can do this. So let me ask you, which of three alternative miracle scenarios to the status quo, which is always unacceceptable compared to everything else, which we end up saying we're back to the status quo, would be, one, the private plans are willing to actually compete to deliver the current level of services at a lower cost and having beneficiaries pay for any delta that goes above that. So that's one, that's probably Brian's miracle scenario, but how realistic is that to happen? The second is that suddenly the public program, traditional fee-for-service, becomes miraculously efficient and suddenly does all the stuff that we say it can do without just doing squeezing down provider reimbursements as the standard administered pricing way around the cost. And the third scenario is we can actually pay for all this stuff and pay more than we already say we can't afford currently.
And, Tom, thank you for taking us to the science fiction phase of today's discussion. But, Brian, why don't you take that on?
I just want to make sure I didn't misunderstand. I am in favor of competitive pricing for all plans, not that's my science fiction.
We're not going to compete by getting paid more and offering more benefits.
Right.
Something like 95% of traditional Medicare, just to toss a figure out.
I am for the federal government buying the entitlement benefit package from the lowest cost plan in each county. And in some counties, private plans will be the low bidders. In some counties, I fully expect fee-for-service Medicare to be the low bidder.
comments? Simon?
Wow. So one of the things that may happen as MA rates come down is that plans that have previously been zero premium start introducing premiums, and there are some that have done that for 2009. So the question there, I suppose, will be, are the premiums lower than the alternative cost of buying MedSup and Part D, such that they're still offering some value for the beneficiary plus whatever the extras are? So you could see that that might be how some of it may evolve, but that doesn't really sidestep the distributional question, which I mentioned in my sort of opening few comments, which is that clearly there are a number of low-income seniors at the moment who are using this as a income supplementation program in a way that the first scenario you described would not reproduce. So they would take a hit under that scenario, I guess. As to your second, whether fee-for-service can magically become sort of optimally efficient, I'm skeptical about that because I think there are some intrinsic design flaws in a system that only reimburses for volume, not for quality or appropriateness. And the reason that, for example, fee-for-service in Miami is out of control is not because the government is unable to use its monopsony power to hold down the cost per widget. It's that it has no basis whatsoever for influencing the number or the mix of widgets that are supplied. And so while you maintain that fee-for-service, open-access, non-network reimbursement mechanism, then it, I think, will be incapable of generating the efficiencies that you have talked about. And then the third scenario you talk about is, well, can we just instead pay, can it instead just be fiscally affordable as it moves forward? I suppose if you want to kind of be unapocalyptic, you could say that the cost of Medicare has doubled in the last 7 years, and so why should we worry about the fact that it might double in the next decade? But I think that's too glib an answer, because the reality is that on its current trajectory, if not in the next few years, but certainly in the next decade or two, at the current rate of Medicare growth, and indeed healthcare spending growth as a whole, it will have a very large crowd-out effect, not just on central government spending, but on goods and services that individuals might want. We know that in the commercial, but the pre-65 part of the healthcare system, part of the pressure being felt by families on the constraints on their real wages is because such a high proportion of the growth which would otherwise have flowed to real wages has flowed to the cost of healthcare. And we can certainly, we need to have a conversation about how we organize the financing mechanism, both in Medicare and in the healthcare delivery system as a whole. But to blame the costs on premiums or on MA is rather like blaming the fever on the thermometer. The thermometer is just taking the temperature of what's actually happening in the care delivery system, and until we get serious about changing that, we will not have the impacts that you're looking for.
So Liz Fowler said that hope springs eternal, that we will have thoughtful dialogue in Congress. I think we can say with some degree of certainty and confidence that we try to bring you thoughtful dialogue here at Health Affairs, both in the papers that have been published on this topic as well as the briefing today. I want to close by saying thank you once again to Atlantic Philanthropies for making all of this possible. And join me now in thanking our panelists for a terrific discussion. Thank you very much.